Flame streamed from him like some hellish mane. He was gaining. 70 feet. 50. The bull lowered his heads, 6 horns ready to gore me. I aimed straight for the pillars. 30. Heat scorched my back through the armor. The wolf shot between the right and rear pillar, its sides softening from the heat. The air in my lungs burned. The bull plowed into the rear pillar. The metal column careened, tilting, the priest atop it scrambling to maintain his purchase. I twisted the wolf into a turn. 3 of the bull's horns had pierced the pillar, biting deep into the red-hot metal. He lurched to the right, but the horns remained stuck, trapping 2 of his heads. I dropped my bow and snapped Dakan together. Instead of backing up and pulling his horns loose, the beast pushed forward. The pillar held. He shook his left head back and forth, trying to rip the horns free through the metal. The pillar shuddered, swinging. I darted in. Heat slammed into me like a suffocating wall. I plunged Dakan into the bull's captive head, straight into his ear. He brayed in fury and pain. I stabbed it again and again, in the ear, in the eye, in the nose, over and over. The bull roared, throwing all of his weight to the side, trying to get away from my spear. Something snapped. The horns ripped through the pillar's side. The metal column sagged, toppled, and plunged to the ground like a felled tree. The priest atop it had no time to react. He flailed, his robes flaring out like wings, and fell. He hit the ground and found me there, above him. I plunged Dakan into his skull. The Mavir convulsed, his robes flapping. I vaulted onto the wolf, and we broke into a gallop. Go, go, go. With a deep bellow, the bull gave chase. His hooves smashed into the jerking priest. The Mavir exploded. The blast wave slammed into us, the heat agonizing despite the 50 yards between us. The wolf stumbled, its melting legs too soft to hold our weight. I jumped and rolled through the ash. Pain stabbed through my left thigh. A horrible scream deafened me, like a human howling in agony into a copper bell. I clamped my hands over my ears. The scream rang out and died. The shaking ground announced the bull bearing down on me. I jumped to my feet. The beast tore toward me. Only 2 heads now, one of them with half a horn. 50 feet. 20. Steady. Steady. Now. I jumped aside. The bull's momentum carried it well past me, too fast to stab. The wolf limped forward, its legs a soft mess of bending metal. The bull slowed, turning. Stabbing those thick necks would be like trying to saw through a telephone pole with a pocket knife. The legs were a better option. It couldn't run without its knees. The world turned dark. Pain exploded in my head, chest, and stomach, as if my whole body was rebelling against me. The ground spun and fell on my head. I clawed through the agony, desperate to hold on to consciousness. Feedback from the broken blood ward. Someone had shattered my spell. I floated through the sea of pain. Reverse the magic flow, pull it inward, exhale out, wrap it. Reality exploded around me in a cacophony of light and sound. 10 yards from me, the bull shook his head, trying to dislodge the metal wolf impaled on his horns and melting over his face. The construct had sacrificed itself for me. Above me, a nightmarish meld of wolf and human bounded onto a pillar, digging his claws into the metal, scrambling up. Derek, you stupid idiot! It's too high! It's too hot! He jumped onto the top of the pillar. The Mavir vomited a torrent of fire. Derek dropped under it, planting 1 hand on the pillar. The fur on his arm burst into flame. He swung his legs, knocking the priest off, and leaped after him, ripping into the Mavir as they fell. They crashed to the ground in a cloud of ash. Run! I screamed. Run! A lupine shape rushed out of the cloud. Derek, sprinting at full speed. The priest detonated. The blast wave picked Derek up, every hair on his body igniting at the same time, and tossed him like a rag doll. The metal scream erupted again. I clamped my hands over my ears. To the right, another head melted from the bull's shoulders. He was down to two horns now. Derek staggered upright, swaying, stunned. Burns smoked all over his body. His skin crawled, sprouting fur as Like V tried to repair its host. The bull sighted him.
Hey, here, look at me!
He didn't see me. I was off to the side, and Derek was directly in his line of sight, still dazed.
No.
I sprinted to the bull, melting the armor over my thigh, pulling blood onto my hands in twin ribbons. The bull spun toward me.
You can't have him.
The bull of Tophet charged, but I was too close. He didn't have time to build up speed. I twisted to the side, rammed Dakan between the metal scales over its shoulder, and thrust my hands into bovine fireblood.
Hassad.
Mine. Magic tore out of me. The pain shook me to my core. It felt like my bones cracked open and the marrow was sucked out into the void. The threshold for taking the bull over was too high. The bull brayed. On top of his pillar, the remaining Mavir screeched in agony. Our magic collided, wrestling for control of the beast. Pressure clamped me, the power inside the bull a dense knot. Derek would live. No matter what it cost me, he would walk away from this. Blood drenched my lips. My eyes and nose bled, and I fed every drop of it into the creature. The bull of Tophet had been crafted from Moloch's divine power. I was trying to rip a god's beast away from him.
Amahe, Amahe, Amahe. Obey, obey, obey.
My whole body went numb. Tears drenched my eyes, making it hard to see. I couldn't feel my hands. I was teetering on the edge of a chasm, about to plunge to my death.
Amahe.
The cocoon of magic within the bull burst. My magic flooded through it. A malevolent, primitive intelligence that was the creature's consciousness connected with mine, accepting the bridle of my will. I felt the overwhelming strength of the bull's body, its weight, its power. I jerked my hands out and shoved the bull's mind at the last Mavir's pillar. The creature charged and smashed into the metal column. The pillar quaked. The bull bounced back and struck again, like a battering ram. The priest above ripped his robes and fell to his knees, wrapped in flames. The air shimmered and split, and through the gap, a giant reached out with a perfect hand. He stood 80 feet tall, his face heartbreaking in its beauty. A mane of blonde hair fell onto wide shoulders covered in ancient armor that glowed like a golden mirror. To look into his emerald eyes was to lose yourself. Moloch had come to see me. He had to be burning through his magic at a crazy rate to manifest here and in the giant form. He couldn't possibly keep this up. I had to outlast him. Moloch's fingers closed around the priest, lifting him in the air. He opened his perfect mouth.
You still resist.
I hurled the bull at him. It charged the avatar, thousands of pounds of fury and flame. Moloch reached out with his other hand. The bull connected and melted into his palm. The loss of magic brought me to my knees.
You belong to me. Come to me, Princess of Shinar, and know paradise.
Go fuck yourself. Moving my tongue was a colossal effort. I had lost so much magic.
You can't defy me. My will is absolute. Your mother will die. Your grandmother will be my slave. And you will sit beside me.
I'll kill you and obliterate your name. Nobody will remember you, and you will pass into nothingness. He smiled. Magic radiating from him, warm and brilliant. It pulled me like a magnet. It made me want to weep. Moloch leaned forward, reaching for me. I could do nothing. I was spent. A silver werewolf thrust himself between us. Power boiled out of him, hungry and ancient, so potent it took my breath away. Moloch stared at him. His eyes widened. Derek raised his head and howled. It sounded like a vicious battle prayer. The child-eating god took a step back. The rip in reality collapsed, the final echoes of his voice dancing on the wind.
Until we meet again.
I fell on my back, my arms wide, and stared at the blue sky. The air tasted so sweet. Everything hurt. Derek howled again, singing a song of triumph and blood. In the distance, wolves howled, answering him. 18. The old ruin around me lay silent. I had no idea what it had been in its past life. A hotel, a concert hall, a school. 2 stories tall, it was perfectly round and rose 50 feet above us in a dome punctured by rectangular windows, their glass long gone. The center of it lay open. Dust stained the once polished marble floor. Along the walls, columns supported a narrow balcony. Somewhere within the ruin, there were probably stairs that led up there, but neither Derek nor I looked for them. He lay next to me in the dirt. He hadn't bothered changing shapes to ease the strain on Like V, and right now he was shockingly large, a true monster sheathed in silver fur. The box sat between us on a dusty step. Moonlight shone through the windows above, and it set the enchanted bone aglow. I stirred the coals in the metal pot in front of me with a long stick and tossed another handful of dried herbs into it. I had fallen asleep on that battlefield, right in the ashes. Derek had moved me to the grass. When I woke up, hours later, he was the first thing I saw, still in his wolf form, sitting next to me, silhouetted against the setting sun. Soot and blood stained his silver fur. Bald patches marked his right arm, some still blistered and oozing fluid where the heat had cooked him. I asked him if it hurt, like an idiot. Of course it hurt. He lied and said no. The box waited next to him. I had insisted on confirming that Simon was still alive. Once I saw him with my own eyes, the lot of us walked out of the portal, and now we were here, in a ruin on the edge of Unicorn Lane, waiting to settle Derek's debt to a kind priest. The wolves had spread out and hid, forming a perimeter around the ruin. Derek told them to not interfere unless Unicorn Lane spat something particularly nasty in our direction. I had been sitting here for hours, and we hadn't said a single word to each other. He was leaving in 3 days. 2 now. It was after midnight. I didn't want him to go. It was absurd and stupid, and when I thought about him leaving, it hurt. He'd lived. It was enough. He had his life, I had mine, and after tonight, we would go our separate ways. It was for the best. There were so many things I wanted to ask. None of them mattered. Derek sat up, his ears twitched. A strange shape squeezed through one of the empty windows and perched on the balcony, staring down at us with disturbingly human eyes. She was the size of a female lion, and most of her was built like one, but instead of a sandy-colored pelt, her hide was covered with fine brown hair, like the flanks of an Arabian horse. 2 massive wings thrust from her back, their feathers a matching tawny brown flecked with white and gold. Her feline legs didn't end in paws, but in monstrous hands with oversized cat-like fingers armed with sickle claws. Her thick neck supported a nightmarish head, her face a strange evolution of a lion muzzle with a flat feline nose, split upper lip, a large maw revealing fangs, and disturbingly human cheekbones and forehead. If lions had evolved the way humans had, they might have looked like her. A golden circlet crowned her brow. Thick gold armbands studded with red stones clasped her wrists. The gold necklace around her neck was splattered with dried blood. A female sphinx. My first time seeing one. The sphinx stared at us with glowing turquoise eyes. Creepy. She opened her mouth.
Do you burn the funeral herbs for yourself or for the wolf?
Her whispery voice raised the hair on the back of my neck. I burn them for you, I told her. I brought a coin with me so you may take it to the ferryman. I know the local Thanatos. He's a kind man. He will guide you well.
How thoughtful of you, human.
Her claws scraped the stone.
The wolf hasn't touched the treasure. He may go.
You killed my friend, Derek said. A holy man.
He touched the treasure. He had to die.
He helped many people, Derek said. He healed the sick, he fed the hungry, and he shielded the weak. He didn't steal the box, yet you killed him. Her eyes shone.
His heart tasted like any other.
You knew he no longer had the box. He wasn't the one who stole it. You could have chosen to spare him, Derek said.
She seemed to think it over.
Yes.
You could have given him a swift death.
She flexed her fingers, and her claws scraped the stone again.
I like prey that fights back. You have not touched the treasure. You are not my prey. Leave.
Slowly, deliberately, Derek put his clawed hand on the box.
How about now?
The Sphinx dove off the balcony. Derek leaped off the floor, meeting her in midair. The wolf and lion collided in a whirlwind of bodies and fur. They rolled around, snarling, growling, biting and clawing.
I stirred my herbs. It was his fight. That's why he'd returned to the city. I had to let him have it.
The Sphinx clawed Derek's side, ripping through skin and muscle. He gripped one of her wings and bit it where it joined her body. She screamed, and they rolled again, smashing against the columns. Dust rose in the air. I coughed. Blood splashed the marble. Derek grasped the Sphinx by her hind foot and swung her at the nearest column. Her back smashed into stone with a crunch. Outside, one of the wolves snarled. Hopefully it was nothing. If they snarled again, I'd have to go and check it out. The Sphinx broke free and leapt at Derek, sinking her claws into Derek's shoulders and kicking, trying to disembowel him with her hind legs. He grasped her by her throat, tore her free of him like she was a feral cat, and bit her neck. Blood washed over them, spurting out between his teeth. He chewed on her, carving through flesh with vicious focus. She raked him with her claws, but he kept biting. The Sphinx sagged. Her strikes lost their power. She went limp. The light in her eyes dimmed. Derek let go. She fell to the floor in a crumpled heap. He drove his hand into her chest and ripped her heart out. She shuddered one last time and went still. Derek dropped the heart. He raised his bloody face to the moon and howled. It wasn't triumphant. It was mournful. It gripped your heart and squeezed it, telling you that life was not forever. The last notes of the howl died, melting into the night. Derek turned. His warrior form condensed in on itself, folding into a human shape. His eyes were full of golden light. Uh-oh. He started toward me, naked, bloody, his eyes on fire. I stood up. He kept coming. Earth to werewolf, mission complete. He lunged at me. I had no time to dodge. He pressed my back into a column. His face was inches from mine. An electric thrill dashed through me. Fear and excitement rolled into one. He was looking at my face, at my eyes, at my lips. I get that killing her was very exciting. He leaned close, resting his forehead on mine. No rational thought remained in his eyes, only hunger and need. Mayday, mayday, stop! He took a deep breath, sampling my scent. Stop! Derek! Oh, shit. He leaned back an inch. A slow smile stretched his lips, but there was no humor in it. It looked harsh and bitter.
Well, look at that. The illustrious Julie Olson remembered my name.
Cold drenched me. You knew?
Yes.
It had to have been the blood armor. Since when?
Since the beginning. I saw you ride into the city.
How? My face is different. My scent is different. He leaned closer, his lips almost touching my ear.
I don't need to see your face or smell you. I could tell it was you by the way you rode your horse.
My brain screeched to a halt. He straightened, giving me more room, and I saw his eyes. They brimmed with cold fire. He was pissed off beyond all reason. Really? He was mad? He had some nerve. You knew and you didn't tell me. Was it fun? He pondered me.
Not sure. Let me think about it.
I sensed some hostility. He pretended to ponder it.
Really? Now what could have caused that, I wonder?
Why don't you tell me? Just lay it all out. He bared his teeth. His voice was a snarl.
You left. No goodbye. No explanation. You fucking left me behind like an old knife you didn't want.
You could have found me any time you wanted. I called home. I told them exactly where I was. If you wanted to talk to me, all you had to do was pick up the phone.
And said what? Please come back? You made your move. I made mine. I waited for you to come back. You didn't. You made it plain you didn't want anything to do with me. Was I supposed to wait for you here forever like a good boy?
Was I? I was in love with you for 5 years, and you couldn't even be bothered to look me up.
You were a little kid.
And if I hadn't left, I would have stayed a little kid in your head forever. I grew up. I thought that if I left, eventually you would track me down. Things would be different.
Things were fine. We were a good team.
I didn't want to be a team. I wanted to be a couple. He stared at me. My gods, how can you be so dense? If I stayed here, we would still be a good team.
That was enough for me. I liked having you close. I liked knowing where you were and what you were doing.
It's not always about you. If I hadn't left, we would still be right where we were before, with me hoping and hoping and you never making up your mind. Nothing would have changed.
You didn't give me a chance, he snarled. You left.
I left because I had a gaping hole in my soul from the severed binding. I didn't ask you to come with me because for once in your life, I wanted you to show me that you loved me. I wanted you to fight for me. I wanted you to do the ridiculous werewolf mating thing where you bring me food and flirt with me and growl at any other male who tries to hit on me. I had these ridiculous fantasies of you dramatically showing up out of nowhere. When you left Atlanta, I thought you were coming to find me. I waited by the fucking window like a moron every morning for 3 weeks.
I left Atlanta because I had to figure out what I was. It had nothing to do with you.
Nothing you do anymore has anything to do with me. I don't even know why we're having this conversation.
We're having it because I want some fucking answers.
I got tired of waiting for you, Derek. You have done quite well for yourself, Beta of Ice Fury. You became the man I always thought you would be if only you got out of your own way. That man didn't want Julie Olson, but here we are, with you staring at me like you need me to keep breathing. What, am I finally pretty enough for you?
He stepped away from me. His gaze was impossible to hold. Okay, I hear you. Be careful what you wish for, princess.
He turned and walked to the Sphinx. That's right, I called. Keep walking. He swiped her heart off the floor, turned to face me, and bit into it. Blood dripped down his chin. For a moment, Derek froze, encased in moonlight, looking at something a million miles away with glowing eyes. A feral wolf smile bent his lips. He turned away and walked out. I sagged against the column. Too much. Too much magic. Too much danger. Too much Derek. Too much. It didn't matter. He'd killed the creature he'd come here to kill. He would go back to Alaska now. It was over. I should be glad for him. I should be relieved for myself. I got things off my chest. I cleared the air. I could finally let go of him forever and be free. Everything went according to plan. So why the hell did it hurt so much? I sat by Simon's gravestone and watched the sky slowly lighten above Unicorn Lane. I was so beat up. My body, my mind, my heart, everything was bruised. I just felt hurt and hollow. Sienna walked out of the shadows, her cloak swirling around her. She carried a plastic bottle filled with clear liquid. The liquid shone slightly, not exactly glowing, but filled with its own subtle light. Very mystical, I told her. I try. She looked me over. Her eyes were distant. Magic shimmered along her skin. To my sensate vision, she glowed with an intense, brilliant blue, the tendrils of her magic stretching out in coils, as if stirred by a phantom wind. Her voice flowed, suffused with magic. "You are so tired," the witch oracle said. "I am. Did I do enough? Did I change the future?" She shook her head. "No." Fear drenched me like a bucket of icy water. I'd failed. I'd signed Kate's death warrant. But you've made it less certain. The words took a moment to penetrate. Damn it, Sienna. I want to show you something. I saw it for the first time just after midnight. She crouched and poured the contents of her bottle on the ground. The liquid gathered in a depression of the pitted asphalt, and she touched it with one long, slender finger. Vapor streamed from the surface of the water, rising in a shimmering curtain. A dark-haired woman appeared within it, her features familiar, so much like my own. Kate. She smiled, picked up a small blonde toddler, and set the child on her hip. The toddler looked at me through the curtain of time, her big brown eyes bright on her tiny face. Goosebumps broke out on my skin. "This is your sister," Sienna said softly. "This vision exists because yesterday you brought Moloch up short." The vapor vanished as the water dissipated into nothing. "You bought them time," Sienna told me. "How much?" "Who can say?" Sienna gave me a one-shouldered shrug. "Can I see them now?" "No. You cannot see them, and you cannot leave." The oracle looked at me with haunted eyes. "What is it?" I asked. "If one day I wrong you, Julie, will you forgive me?" "Yes. We all come up short once in a while. You're my friend." She smiled. She looked like she was about to cry. "Is something wrong?" She shook her head. "A promise is a promise. I hope you always feel that way." Her magic spiraled around her and vanished, pulled in. An ordinary young woman stood in front of me. My friend was back. "We should have tea and chocolate tomorrow," Sienna said. "I will take you to the new bakery on Smith Avenue. My treat." "I'll take you up on that generous offer." Sienna smiled. Epilogue. The sun had risen, and the magic still held. Normally I would have waited till the beginning of a new wave, but this was too important. I picked up the box, wrapped in purple velvet, with my left hand and a bag with my right, took a deep breath, and reached for the hidden connection, letting it carry me to a place at once near and impossibly far. The scent of flowering trees washed over me. I stood on the balcony of a grand palace. Below me, a breathtaking garden bloomed, trees and flowers flourishing among shallow ponds and gentle streams flowing through man-made beds. Delicate ornamental pavilions of pink and white stone dotted the greenery. The water gardens, one of the wonders of the Old Kingdom.
"It's been a while," a familiar deep voice said behind me.
I turned. My grandfather strode onto the balcony, dressed in a white tunic and loose white pants. His feet were bare. His dark hair, strategically salted with gray, fell on his shoulders. He had the face of a sage, beautiful beyond human limits, yet wise and self-assured. "I've been busy, but I come bearing gifts."
"Is that my wolf in your bag?"
"What's left of it." I let the bag fall to the floor. The fabric vanished, revealing melted remnants of the wolf. "I broke it. I'm sorry."
"You're standing in front of me, so it must have done its job. Did it serve you well?"
"It saved me. Can you fix it?"
"It is only a machine," Roland said. "Did you mourn it?"
"I did." Grandfather smiled.
"Be careful. I will rebuild it, but the more attached you become to it, the more agency it will obtain. Such is the nature of magical constructs. There may come a time when it will become an entity with an independent will."
"I'll keep that in mind." I offered him the bundle of velvet.
"What is this?"
"An artifact Moloch desperately wanted. I think it might be one of yours." Roland moved his hand. A table sprouted from the balcony's floor. The bundle landed on it, and the velvet fell away. He laughed. Two bottles of Corona appeared on the table, ice forming on their sides. Two matching chairs materialized by the balcony rail. Roland picked up a beer.
"Tell me everything."
We had finished the beers by the time I was done.
"You've done well," he said.
"Thank you." Praise from Grandfather, both rare and precious.
"Would you like to know what this is?"
"Please."
"We will need the night sky for this."
Roland waved his hand. Sunset splashed across the sky and melted behind the horizon. Indigo flooded the sky, familiar constellations shining within its depths like diamonds. Inside of his prison, Grandfather was God. Roland touched the box. The lid opened slowly. A gentle blue glow emanated from within and splayed out, forming glowing spider webs of constellations above and coastlines below. So beautiful.
"When I was 14 years old, my tutor challenged me to make a moving map. It had to always know its user's location and adjust with the seasons and the tides. It had to be beautiful and effortless to use."
"You made an ancient version of GPS?" Roland grinned.
"Yes, but mine is so much more stylish. It sat forgotten among other trinkets I created, until years later, the merchants from the Middle Sea arrived. They brought delicate pottery, statues of marble, gold and copper, olive oil, perfume and wine. We wanted to establish a persistent trade route, but they told us the sea was perilous and full of monsters. It was easy for the ships to be blown off course. So I gifted them this map, and we traded for 2 centuries until no more ships came."
That was Roland, a discarded school project that guided fleets across the Mediterranean. Just an afterthought. The ancient Greeks or their ancestors must have treasured it beyond all measure, even binding a sphinx to protect it. And he treated it as a forgotten toy that had turned up in the attic. "I'm going to leave it here with you," I told him.
"As you wish. I can probably make a better version of it. Yes, something smaller, more handheld."
He waved his hand and 2 new bottles appeared on the table.
"Will you sit with me for a while?"
"Of course I will." I took my shoes off and leaned back in my chair. The beer in my hand was crisp and cold, and the night sky above us was so vast.
"It will only get harder from here on out," Roland said. "I'm afraid you will suffer."
"Life is suffering. Why should it be different for me?"
"Because you're my granddaughter and very precious to me. I would spare you if I could."
"Aw, you say the sweetest things, Grandfather." He laughed. We clinked our beers and watched the stars glow.
Rider Extras. The Letter. 1 month after the Battle of Atlanta. Order of the Merciful Aid. The Citadel. Wolf Trap, Virginia. 22182. 14 September, 2045. Transcript for the record. 4. Grandmaster Angevin Damien, 3rd Knight Preceptor of the Order of Merciful Aid. Individuals present: Grandmaster Damien Angevin, Knight Inquisitor Bruce Dolivo, Knight Secretary Timothy Hansen. Recording. Subject: Battle of Atlanta. Attempted invasion by Roland, a.k.a. Nimrod of Shinar. B.D. Reading.
To understand the conflict that took place in Atlanta resulting in the Battle of Atlanta in August 2045, it is helpful to consider two theories. First, the forces of magic and technology exist in a balance. Both must be present for life to survive. The complete absence of either results in a mass extinction event, as we saw during the Lighthouse Keeper incident in Palmetto, Georgia. Using technology or magic through means of devices and spells increases its respective potency in the world at the cost of the opposite force. So, the more spells the population uses, the stronger is the magic and the weaker is the tech, and vice versa. This continues until the imbalance becomes too great and the system autocorrects. This is known as the balance theory. D.A.
I'm well aware of this. Last time I checked, I wasn't an idiot.
B.D. Reading.
The shift, the return of magic to our technological civilization, is an example of such correction. The correction isn't instant, but gradual, which is why we're now experiencing magic waves with periods of technology in between. That is also why magic destroys objects with a high technological concentration, such as tall buildings, aircraft, and computers.
D.A. Bruce, my time is valuable. Get to the fucking monkey.
B.D. Reading.
Second, the shift isn't the first such correction our world has experienced. Evidence suggests that several advanced civilizations existed in prehistory, based on the practice of magic, and that they obtained a level of knowledge and innovation at least equal to or surpassing our own. They had experienced their own shift, which brought waves of technology and ultimately resulted in their demise. This is known as the second shift theory.
D.A.
You're doing this on purpose.
B.D.
Yes, you asked me to do this. I dropped everything, and now you're going to sit and listen to my damn report.
D.A.
You always did love the sound of your own voice.
B.D.
And 30 years later, you still can't pay attention to the lecture. I'm still doing your fucking homework for you, Damien.
D.A.
That is a lie, and you know it. I did my own damn homework. It's your job to investigate. It's my job to decide what to do about your findings.
B.D.
Oh no, I'm losing my train of thought due to the constant interruptions. I think I'm going to have to start from the beginning.
D.A.
I already know this. The kid knows this. Tim, is any of this news to you, or were you awake during the classes at the academy?
T.H.
No, Grandmaster. Yes, Grandmaster.
D.A.
Tim, tell me who Roland is.
T.H.
He's an exceptionally powerful wizard born in the prehistoric times when magic civilizations flourished. It's rumored that he is the basis for biblical figure of Nimrod, the man who built the Tower of Babel. When the first shift destroyed the magic civilization, Nimrod went into hibernation. The current shift woke him up and he took the name Roland. He possesses godlike powers, he uses blood magic, and he may have created vampires. He seeks world dominion and is classified as extraordinarily hostile. BD.
How is it you have a kid who uses words like flourished? Give him to me. He's too smart for you.
DA.
Get your own smart kid. This one is mine. Just give me the Cliff Notes version, Bruce.
BD.
Fine. Think of magic as water and technology as a dam holding it back. A little bit of water always flows through, but it's barely a trickle. Then we have the Industrial Revolution, a couple of world wars, and the space race, and information technology. The more we progress, the greater is the pressure on the dam until eventually the damn thing starts cracking. We think it really started sometime in the 70s when all that psychic crap hit. So the magic keeps leaking through the cracks widen, and eventually Roland wakes up, probably sometime in the 90s. He crawls out of whatever cave he was sleeping in and starts running around waiting for the dam to break, which we know it did, and we have our apocalypse. Nobody exactly knows what happened to Roland in the past, but it was some heavy shit, because the man is unhinged. Mad genius, megalomaniac wizard, crazy cosmic powers, the whole enchilada. He's obsessed with rebuilding his ancient kingdom, the Shinar. He settles in Ohio, creates the people, and sets about building the foundation for his kingdom. Shortly after the shift, he meets a woman, Kalina, and falls in love with her. She becomes pregnant, and at first, he's happy. But then he decides to kill the child in the womb.
D.A.
Why?
B.D.
He's had children in the past, and it didn't go well. They were powerful, and every one of them died, or turned against him and then died. No one knows how many of his own kids he murdered.
D.A.
Clearly Father of the Year material.
B.D.
Kalina had other ideas. She somehow seduced Roland's warlord and ran off with him. Magic may have been involved. Roland chased them. At some point, she gave birth to a girl. Roland caught up with them, so she gave the baby to the warlord and confronted her husband to buy them time. She did a damn good job, by all accounts. Bought her daughter 25 years before Roland learned of her.
D.A.
What happened to Kalina?
B.D.
She stabbed Roland in the eye, and he killed her.
D.A.
This has turned into a Lifetime movie.
B.D.
Do you even know where that saying comes from?
D.A.
Yes, do you?
B.D.
Timothy, bonus question. Where does the phrase Lifetime movie come from?
T.H.
Lifetime was a basic cable channel that provided programming targeted toward women and featuring women in leading roles. Lifetime's original content included made-for-TV movies, which often portrayed women overcoming adversity resulting from men's actions.
B.D.
I'll trade you Lisa for him.
D.A.
Pass. What happened with the girl and the warlord?
B.D.
The warlord decided to make the girl into a killer, and he did. This woman can kill anything. There are reports of her fighting in the pits south of the border when she was 8 years old. Eventually, the warlord died, and from 15 until 18, she ended up in a guardianship under one of ours, Knight Diviner Greg Feldman.
D.A.
We had her?
B.D.
Yep.
D.A.
Did Feldman know?
B.D.
Looks that way. He tried to enroll her into Academy twice, and she bolted both times. You can check the enrollment logs yourself. She went by Kate Daniels.
D.A.
Well, fucking shit.
B.D.
Eventually, she ended up in Atlanta and ran into Curran Leonard.
D.A.
The first Beast Lord of the Pack?
B.D.
Yep. Apparently, there was some sort of instant attraction. It gets better. Ted Moynihan at this point is in charge of the Atlanta chapter.
D.A.
That fuckwit again. The gift that keeps on giving. I still don't understand how he got to be the Knight Protector. If that man was in charge of nothing except his own dick, sooner or later he'd suspect it of presenting a danger to humanity.
B.D.
He was one of the original 50 people Stone knighted. Stone liked him for dependability and promoted him to Knight Sergeant. And after he died, Heath took over, and Heath prized seniority over ability. We're talking about the same man who commissioned a life-size portrait of Stone and had it framed in gold. D.A.
And if Stone was alive, he would have brained Heath with it.
B.D.
And I would have paid good money to see that.
Greg Feldman, the night diviner who served as Kate's guardian, is murdered. Moynihan isn't investigating it.
D.A. Why the hell not?
B.D.
Feldman had issues with him. Daniels shows up and Moynihan hires Daniels as an agent of the order to solve the murder.
D.A.
What the actual fuck?
B.D.
Your guess is as good as mine. This thing is actually a lot more complicated, but you asked for highlights. She works for us for a bit. Meanwhile, her daddy wakes up his sister. Her name is Era, and she is the human equivalent of a nuke. In ancient times, she was his warlord. She's got a list of titles a mile long, things like Plague Bringer and City Eater, and she is even less sane than her brother. For some reason, Roland sends her to Atlanta, and she runs into her niece. Shit hits the fan. A plague almost wipes out the city. Crazy crap happens, but eventually Daniels kills her. In the process, it becomes clear that she and Leonard are an item, and Moynihan thinks shapeshifters aren't people and should be put down. So our girl quits and goes off to be the Beast Lady.
D.A.
B.D. You okay?
D.A.
Just think about it. If only we'd managed to reel her in. We could have had our own nuke.
B.D. Sigh.
Yep, this is what happens when you promote people beyond their intelligence. Anyhow, some years pass and Roland and Daniels keep coming into conflict with each other remotely. Meanwhile, Heath is leading us into a political nightmare, ass first. The Order's reputation plummets. Moynihan, who has gone full lunatic by now, becomes convinced that the only way the Order can survive is to have a holy war against an evil enemy.
D.A.
And we know this how?
B.D.
He wrote a memo to Heath about it.
D.A.
Continue.
B.D.
Moynihan looks around for some enemy to fight and settles on Roland. Roland decides it's time to meet his daughter in person, so he sends his warlord to get her.
D.A.
Hugh Dambray, another massive pain in the ass.
B.D.
He was a pain until Roland threw him away.
D.A.
That man is a butcher. Right now, he sits safely in Kentucky playing house with his new wife. And the moment he steps foot outside of that state, I'll be on him like white on rice.
B.D.
Okay, moving on. Moynihan makes sure that Dambray slaughters the entire Atlanta chapter and burns a deep cover agent embedded with Dambray. That agent is...
D.A.
Are you going to tell us?
B.D.
It's a dramatic pause, Damien. That agent is Night Crusader Nicholas Feldman, Greg Feldman's son. Didn't see that coming, did you?
D.A.
How does this woman keep doing this? How is it every time her trajectory intersects with the Order, we have a major disaster on our hands and she sees us in the worst possible light?
B.D.
Luck? Coincidence? Fate? Anyway, Heath refuses to go to war with Roland and for some reason decides to promote Feldman to Knight Protector and set him up in charge of the Atlanta chapter. Mariana de Leon calls for Heath to step down and your name is brought up as the possible replacement. You know what happened next. While we were busy sorting all that out and fighting our civil war, Roland and Daniels came into open conflict. This family has an inborn ability to claim land.
D.A.
Define claim.
B.D.
They become bound to the land and all living creatures within it. If a significant magic power enters their domain, they know and can track it. It's something that had been deliberately bred into them to make them better rulers. Apparently, there is a big price tag attached to all this, but we won't go into that. Short version, Roland tries to claim Atlanta, and Daniel blocks him and claims it instead. They make a deal. Lennart gives up the pack, and Daddy Dearest will mind his manners for the next 100 years. Basically, Lennart and Daniels bought some time.
D.A.
Didn't last.
B.D.
Nope. He keeps poking her with a stick.
She and Leonard get married and she gives birth to a baby boy, and that just makes her father's meddling worse. While he's harassing her, an ancient dragon decides it would be a great idea to invade the world. He opens a secret dimension where he's been hiding with his slave army and starts capturing people and boiling them alive. The entire city comes together to fight him, and somehow Daniel convinces Roland to help her. They kill the dragon, and the moment he croaks, Roland turns on his daughter. When the dust settles, Roland is gone, jettisoned out of our world. D.A. Where? B.D. Nobody knows. Feldman has written a report in which he claims that Roland is imprisoned in the realm outside of our existence and can never escape. I pressed him for an explanation, but he hasn't given one yet. He doesn't have the highest opinion of us. Like Moynihan, he's been writing memos for years explaining that Roland is going to invade and Daniels is a danger to democracy. D.A. I've read them. His points were valid, but we had more urgent things on our plate. What happened to Daniels? B.D. She unclaimed the land and went back to living in the suburbs with her ex-beast lord husband. D.A. Just like that? B.D. Just like that. Here's the kicker. You remember the aunt she killed? Era, the plague bringer? The one with all the titles? D.A. Yes. B.D. She got resurrected on the battlefield. D.A. Bruce, death is forever. In all the decades since the shift, nobody has ever come back to life. B.D. Well, she did. Rumors said she wasn't fully dead, and she and Daniels have some sort of arrangement. Shortly after the dust settles, she leaves. And here is another tidbit for you. Years ago, Daniels rescued a street kid, a little girl named Julia Olson. Leonard and Daniels formally adopted her. Julia, they call her Julie, was a sensate and had some weird powers. Word is, she and Era left together. Their whereabouts are officially unknown. D.A. So, we have an ancient warlord princess running around the country, possibly starting plagues, and, good news, she found an apprentice with weird powers. Fantastic. How sure are we that Roland is no longer a threat? B.D. 100% sure. Daniels is unconcerned, and she would be his primary target. As to Era, we will find her. D.A. What makes you so sure? B.D. Because she looks like this. Passes photograph. D.A. How tall is she? B.D. 6'2". D.A. When you said she was thousands of years old, I didn't expect that. B.D. No, I know this look. D.A. What look? B.D. Damien. D.A. Yes? Is there something you want to tell me off the record? B.D. No, I want it on the record. It's Timothy's job to record every word that passes here, and I want to be damn sure that he puts this in writing. Do you understand, Knight Secretary Hansen? T.H. Yes, Knight Inquisitor. B.D. This woman is a weapon of mass destruction. She can do things we can't even imagine. She can make indestructible weapons and armor out of her own blood. She has centuries of education and experience. The shift happened less than 50 years ago. Our most advanced mages are babies compared to her. Leave it alone. D.A. Mm-hmm. B.D. I'm dead serious, Damien. This woman is trouble. Don't get involved. I mean it. D.A. I heard you. Thank you for the report, Knight Inquisitor. The Order appreciates your efforts. B.D. I warned you. Besides, it's Julia Olson we need to focus on. Roland has taken an interest in her. She was seen at his Swan Palace, and his subordinates referred to her as Talmir. That means disciple. Daniels taught her to use bladed weapons. Roland taught her magic, and now Era took her with, and God alone knows what she's teaching her. Three individuals from that family have chosen to pour their knowledge into this child. Why? On top of that, this girl had a front row seat to the mess that is Atlanta's politics for years.
She has close ties to the Pack and the Witch Covens. Also, she's welcome at Hugh Danbury's Kentucky Castle. She worries me.
D.A.
She's what, 18?
B.D.
Just about. We don't have an exact birth date.
D.A.
Young, impressionable, and probably has a shitload of power. Find her for me, Bruce. We can't get Era. We lost Daniels. Danbury was never an option. But we can still get Julie Olson. We can't afford to pass on this one. The ruling family of Shinar isn't the only one waking up. We need the knowledge in her head, or we're going to get outclassed fast.
BD.
I'll find her. The question is, how are you going to convince her to join us?
DA.
She is an impressionable 18-year-old kid. Between the knights and the support staff, we have 80,000 people who chose our side. Just get me to her, and I'll take it from there. Make this a priority, Bruce.
BD.
Understood, Grandmaster.
Knight Inquisitor D'Oliva left the room. DA, holding photograph of Era.
What do you think about the woman, Tim?
TH.
She's very dangerous, Grandmaster.
DA.
I'm sure she is. What was it Bruce said?
Trouble.
TH. Yes, Grandmaster.
DA.
When you get to my age, Tim, you realize that playing it safe isn't always the best strategy. After all, what's life without a little trouble? Don't write that down. We wouldn't want Knight Inquisitor D'Olivo to lose his beauty sleep.
The King of Fire. 4 years after the Battle of Atlanta.
Why do you do this to yourself?
Grandfather sighed. I sat on the floor of the library, basking in a pool of gentle light slipping through the narrow, arched window behind me. Blood and dirt smeared my jeans and my t-shirt. Everything hurt, and sorting through the maze of pain and aches was exhausting. My body was pretty much a single bruise. The right side hurt the most, sending a sharp spike of agony through my insides every time I inhaled. The seventh rib was broken, probably when the bigger one kicked me. I was covering my head at the time, and the broken rib was the lesser of two evils. I was working on it, but I had to conserve magic. They would be coming for me soon. I have my reasons, I told him.
Are they good reasons?
The best. Grandfather sighed again. His handsome face, edged with a neat silvery beard, wore a long-suffering expression. My brother stalked over from the spot by the wall. He moved on all fours, silent like a ghost on padded paws. When I materialized in Grandfather's palace, he'd taken one look at the blood on my face and changed shape in a burst of flesh. In his human version, he was 3 feet 8 inches tall, a perfectly reasonable height for a 5-year-old. I knew this because we measured his height every 6 months. The current freaked-out iteration was about my height, armed with powerful muscle, leonine jaws with 4-inch fangs, and claws that could gut a human like a fish. His fur was so dark it was nearly black, and against that darkness, his gold eyes glowed, 2 blood moons hypercharged with shapeshifter hormones. It's not that bad. It was worse. My brother pawed at the thick chain stretching from the shackles on my leg into empty air. Please leave it, I told him. He caught it with his right hand and pulled, testing the strength. Stop! If he yanked it out of the wall, my whole plan would collapse. He whirled around. The massive jaws gaped and snapped shut, fangs sliding against each other like teeth of a steel bear trap. That's not nice, he snarled. Grandfather stepped forward and rested his hand on my brother's shoulder.
You are late for dinner.
The kid let out a soft half-growl, half-sigh that turned into a whine.
I know. Your sister never does anything without a plan. Off you go.
Do I get a hug? I held out my arms. He grumbled, but padded over and nudged himself into my arms. I hugged him, petting the soft fur. Don't worry. I've got this. He sighed, and then I was holding empty air. He missed my fingers by less than an inch.
Your brother is upset. Grandfather snapped a huge old book closed. Can you blame him? I am upset. Your mother, if she knew, would be upset.
If my mother knew, she would drop everything and ride out to save me. I had to keep that from happening at all costs.
Your grandmother will be livid.
My grandmother was the one who sent me into this hell in the first place. She wanted to come herself, but she was too much. Too tall, too strong, too beautiful, and too full of magic. She would draw attention and be treated with fear and caution her power deserved, while I had learned to hide my power. I was unknown and easily overlooked as a threat.
Why, Moloch? Grandfather asked. Why now?
There are children in the Hell Fortress. He has over 500 people building his citadel. You should see some of them. They're walking skeletons. You look into their eyes and there is nothing there. The stench of it. Sweat, urine, blood, feces, rot of infected flesh permeating the narrow tunnels filled with cells, barely lit with oppressive watery fey lanterns. The voices. The newer captives cried. The ones who had been there for a little while moaned wordlessly like animals. And those who have lasted the longest just stared, wordlessly, glassy-eyed. The air saturated to the brink with a miasma of pain and misery. I'd cried when they dragged me to the cell from the sheer impact of so much human suffering. I had to get out. It was that, or I would break and do something rash. That's why I came here. I had to anchor myself to something light.
This is what Moloch does, Grandfather said. He views his people as fuel to be consumed in order to achieve his means. He feels no remorse. He believes it is as it should be. This is the danger of proclaiming yourself to be a god king. You start believing your own press.
He isn't a god.
No, he is a man. But he is at least as old as me, with all of the education and magic his ancient line bestows, and that makes him infinitely dangerous. I know you are aware of this fact, so I will ask again. Why are you there? You can answer me, or I will tell Kate. Your choice.
I was out of options. I would need his help anyway, eventually. The seer of the Witch Oracle called me.
Grandfather's eyebrows rose. I didn't know you kept in touch.
We're friends. She is only 2 years older than me. We used to have girl days and shop for makeup together. I call her once in a while.
Grandfather frowned, obviously struggling with this information.
I gave him a moment.
Is there a prophecy?
There is. And she'd called me frantic in the middle of the night to deliver it.
Let's hear it.
When magic crests at its peak, the King of Fire will leave his citadel of misery in the western desert and travel east to devour the queen who doesn't rule and sever bloodline reborn. Only the one who shares his power may oppose him. As soon as I heard it, I told my grandmother and we were on the ley line to Arizona before the sun came up. I met Grandfather's gaze. He's going to kill Kate. Nobody would ever harm Kate, not as long as I was breathing. He pondered my words. His eyes grew distant, and for a moment, a different man emerged from his wise and kind facade, younger, harder, vicious, and sharp, like a shark coming to a surface from the depths of the ocean. The immortal wizard king who nearly killed everyone he loved to rule the world. Ah, Grandpa, I missed you.
You cannot kill Moloch.
I'm going to give it a very good try. I had planned a lot of fun surprises.
No, child. When I said you cannot kill him, I meant he regenerates. Our family bred for power over the lands we claim. His line bred for the ability to restore themselves.
I'll chop his head off. I'd like to see him regenerate that.
He will, Grandfather said. I haven't seen it, but my father has.
He was serious. My careful plan collapsed on itself like a house of cards.
How is that possible?
Grandfather shrugged. Magic of a bygone age. The best you can do is destroy enough of him to buy you time to get out. The magic of this moment in history isn't strong enough for rapid reconstruction, and the periods of tech will slow him down even more. Inflict enough damage to assure a temporary death, and he won't be a problem for at least a few months. Dismemberment is your friend.
I gave him my sweet smile. Thank you.
You didn't ask the most important question.
He paused. This was a test. If I asked the correct question, I would be rewarded. If I failed, he would be disappointed. I needed his help desperately. I ran through it in my head. Magic at its peak, the King of Fire, Citadel, Western Desert, the Queen who doesn't rule, the one who shares his power. Here goes nothing. How do I share in Moloch's power? Roland smiled, his magic shining from within. The sun had risen, the clouds parted, the flowers bloomed, and the world smiled with him.
The eyes, Julia. Moloch's power is in his eyes.
The library vanished. I was back on the piss-soaked straw in a dank cell, chained to the wall. The gaunt woman across gave me a blank stare. She probably didn't even notice I was gone. The heavy footsteps echoed through the hallway. A metal bar clanged open. Men filed into the room. Hands grabbed me and hauled me up as someone unlocked my shackles. I hung limp. It was time. I climbed to the apex of the hill, scrambling up the rocky slope. A strong hand caught my wrist and hauled me up like I weighed nothing. My grandmother grabbed me and squeezed me in a crushing hug. All my wounds cried out with a trickle of blood. "How did it go?" she asked. I glanced over my shoulder at the citadel burning behind me. The flames roared, turning the fortress into one massive bonfire staining the night with orange. "He took my eye," I told her. Eris sucked in a sharp breath. "That's okay," I said, and opened my eyes wide, one brown and the other a brilliant, glowing green. "I took one of his." This has been Blood Air, Kate Daniels World, Book 1, written by Ilona Andrews, narrated by Suzanne Elise Freeman. Copyright 2021 by Ilona Andrews. Production copyright by Ilona Andrews, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.